hello everyone, welcome. If you are a guest with us, we just want you to know that Justin, our lead pastor, is currently on sabbatical. He's been on sabbatical August, September. He comes back October when we have our fall lunch. He'll be back with us on that Sunday. And so in the meantime, we've had different guests speaking, myself included, sharing during his absence. And we've been going through a conversation called the Hall of Faith, which is simply an exploration of characters in the Bible that were highlighting their demonstration of faith and trust in Jesus, and reflecting on those characters in ways that we can look at them to help encourage us and where we're at. And so we've been going through this journey, and so that's been our sermon series, and I've been leading the past few weeks, and we're on week three of a kind of a sermon series within a sermon series, okay? It's kind of what we're doing. It's like I have this three-part thing that I've been walking us through, and the first week, 2 weeks ago, I talked about how God is at work, and we wrestled with this reality that God is at work, and we looked at Hebrews 11, and we looked at the life of David, and how God is at work all the time, everywhere. And then last week, we looked at the concept that God is at work through you. We looked at the story of Esther and pulled out some things to help us see through these characters of Mordecai and Esther and how God is at work through you, that he uses us when he's at work. And we're going to take another step forward with this three-part idea. This morning, God is at work, God is at work through you, and God is at work through you in the details. And we're going to look at the story of Ruth and see if we can't pull out some concepts to help us see how God is at work through you in the details of your life. And to that end, my goal this morning isn't to just give you like the whole story of Ruth. Ruth basically takes up four chapters. It's a real simple read. And I don't want to do all the chapters this morning because I really want you to be excited about going home and finishing reading this story. I want you to fall in love. I want you to get excited about reading the story of Ruth with curious and investigative eyes, with asking questions and seeing what God's doing throughout it. So I hope to like rub off a little bit of the energy and the excitement it is when you read God's word and all the things that can come out of it. So I'm not going to do the whole story. We're going to look at one chapter, the very first chapter of Ruth, and we're going to take from that some ideas and concepts that I think might be relevant to this conversation of faith that we're having. And so we're going to look at one chapter this morning of Ruth, and you can go home and read the rest of the story and see what God speaks to you through it. But as you know, for us to get into this story, we got to do a bit of homework, all right? We got to do a little bit of backtracking. We need to understand what's going on. Now, and I do this every time I preach. I try to give some background information, and I think this is important, not simply because I love talking about it, but because I actually believe it helps us read the text better. Or if anything, it allows us to catch things that maybe we would have missed upon just reading it on our own without knowing this information. And so I try to give this background because I do think it's relevant. So we're going to do a little background information to set the backdrop and set the stage for this story of Ruth. And to do that, I need to go back a couple books. If you're familiar with the Hebrew Bible, there's the opening five books. This is called the Pentateuch. It's called the Torah. It's called the books of Moses. And it goes through these five books. And after the five books end, we get to a point where Moses isn't allowed to enter into Canaan, the promised land. And so he has to hand the reins over to Joshua. So we get a book called Joshua. Now, Joshua is a story about a guy that's leading this group of tribal people into the land of Canaan. And so you have Moses is dead. Joshua has taken command, and we'll show this up on the screen here. Joshua's taken command, and he leads the Israelites over to cross the Jordan River into the land of Canaan. So you have this map here, and you can see kind of the circle. That's the region where the Israelites were, roughly, and they had to cross over the river to get into the region that we know is Israel, but it's Canaan is the land at this point in time. And so they're over, and they embark on a 7-year campaign where they're establishing their presence in this region. This lasts for about 7 years. This is the book of Joshua. This is what's happening. And so they're going in and they're fighting battles and doing things, and they're moving into this territory, these 12 tribes. Well, at the end of Joshua is wrapped up. They're in the land of Canaan, and Joshua divides the land up and gives it to the 12 tribes. And so this is what it looks like by time Joshua is done. So you have 10 tribes that are kind of in this northern region, and then you have a couple tribes that are in the southern region. You see Judah here and Benjamin. There's Simeon there, but most of the tribes are up in this northern region. If you remember last week, we talked about the Assyrian army and how the Assyrian army came down and conquered these 10 tribes who are in this northern kingdom. That's those tribes that are up north there. That's what we were talking about. And so he divides the land up to all of these tribes. And so at the time of Judges, when we get to this time of Judges, which is our next slide here, what we see is that Joshua is now dead, and the whole generation of like that Moses and Joshua generation has died off. They're all gone. And Judges in chapter 2 tells us that a new generation begins that doesn't know the stories that were experienced or what God did in the previous generations. They had forgotten that story. So it's a brand new generation that doesn't really know, isn't really connected to those stories that you read about in the Exodus story and the Joshua story. And what happens is that these 12 tribes are now existing as independent tribes, and sometimes there's battles between them. But mostly what happens is that this book gives us this storyline of this cycle of deliverance and sin, or sin and deliverance. And so what happens, if you've ever read the book of Judges, you'll see this very quickly, where the Israelites forget what God had done. They begin to worship the gods that are in the land. They get conquered by these other nations, and they pray for a deliverer, and God sends a deliverer, and they get delivered, and they live in peace for a little while. Then they forget what God has done. Then they begin to worship these other gods, and they get conquered by these other nations. And then God sends a deliverer, and they get delivered. Then they live in peace. Then they forget what God has done. And it's over and over. And if you read the book of Judges, you're just like, what is happening? Why don't these people get it? This is ridiculous. And that's the point. Because we're not too different. How many times do we forget so quickly the things that God has done in our lives, and we turn to our own affairs? But that's a sermon for another day. So the story goes like that for 400 years. This is happening. So when you read the book of Judges, you're reading a timeline of roughly 400 years that this cycle over and over and over and over and over is taking place. Until you get to the very end of Judges, the last chapter and the last verse of Judges reads like this. In those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as they saw fit. So the author of this writing is telling us this was a time, this time of Judges, where it was like the Wild West. Everybody did what they thought was best for them. They had no leader. They had no king. And this is the backdrop. This chaotic, disorderly type of existence is the backdrop for which God is at work. And you say, well, wait a minute, Joe. How is God at work in something like that? Well, if the end of the book of Judges ends with a time where there is no king, and it's a chaotic state, the very next book that you read, which will be Ruth, ends, the last chapter at the very end of Ruth, ends with a genealogy. And this genealogy leads up to the person David. And so in a time when there was no king and everybody did what they saw best, the very next story is a story about God actually bringing about someone who was going to lead them, to bring unity to the people. And this in turn, if you're a little bit of a Bible nerd, when you get to a story in a gospel where Matthew in chapter 1 gives us a long genealogy, and we're like, what is this all about? When you read that genealogy, you see at the top Boaz and Ruth, who are the great-great-grandparents of David. Boaz and Ruth, Obed, Jesse, David, leads to the future Messiah, Jesus. Y'all, God is at work. At a time when there was no king and everybody did what they saw as best, God steps into history and says, you know what, we're going to fix this. And you get the story Ruth. And from Ruth comes King David, and from King David comes Jesus. God is always at work. And times in our lives when we think it can't get worse, and things are chaotic, and they're in disorder, and you're frustrated, and you're not sure what the future's going to bring, and you're wondering where God's at, trust me, God is at work. And that's amazing. And Matthew's going, hey, did you guys know? Look at this. God's at work. In a world where everyone did as they saw best, we're treated to a story where people do what's best for others. And this is the beautiful transition in Ruth. You go from Joshua, goes into the land, divides it up, judges, a bunch of people just trying to live in chaos and disorder. It ends with this disorderly state, and you're going, man, everyone's doing what's best in their own eyes. Then it goes into Ruth. A story about people that actually do what's best for others. And at any point in history, when we look at history and we say, man, it's at its worst, you need to know that God is always raising up people to do something for him. Any time in history. So the book of Ruth begins in the time of the judges. So this story that we're about to read is in the middle of this chaotic, everyone doing what they see best. And that's how God works. He always raises up people who are willing to partner with him and actually do what's best, to partner with him in the story that he's telling. And so this is how Ruth begins. Now, we're going to do a bit of a flyover on chapter 1. We're going to look at a couple observations, and then we're going to land on a third observation that we're going to pull some insights that I think are relevant to this conversation of faith. And so, Ruth begins. It's in the time of the judges, and we're told there's a famine in the land. Some of your Bible translations will tell you there was a famine in Judah. That's not actually in the text. The translators offer that up to you so you can kind of pinpoint where you're at in the story. If you go to the slide here, so Judah is the southern part of the region, and there's a famine in that land. Now, why do we believe it was in the Judah region? Well, because the next information we get in chapter 1 is about a family that lives they live in Bethlehem. I was going to say Benjamin, but it's Bethlehem. And there's this family that lives there. There's a father, a wife, and two kids. And so we're treated to this information about this family. Now, we're going to put a pin on that point. So famine in the land, there's a family that lives there, and that family has to move because of the famine. Pin in that story for a second. We're going to take a little sidebar nerd moment, okay? This is for me, all right? So little sidebar nerd moment. Have you ever seen a movie where the beginning of the movie like sets up information that pays off later on in the movie? I think of like one of my favorite movies, Inception, is this crazy story about, you know, dreams within dreams within dreams. And anyway, wild story, but like the beginning of it, Christopher Nolan sets up this scene and you're not sure what's going on until later on in the movie that it's revealed who these people are and what's happening and where you're at in the story. And it's like this kind of time jump. I love movies like this. And Ruth kind of reads like a movie like that. And here's why. Because we're treated to the information. We're given the names of these two kids that are in this story. The names are Machlon and Chilion, right? And so you can see there, Machlon and Chilion. Now, why is that important? Because the name, the meaning of their names, Machlon in Hebrew means sick. Chilion in Hebrew means wasting away. So right out of the opening gate of this story, we're told that there is a family and the two kids are sick and wasting away. Now, if you know this story, which we'll reveal to you in a little bit, that pays off in a bit. And so it's like the author here is treating us to this reality of something that maybe is coming much, much later. And so, off the nerd moment, back to the story. They're forced to move. They move to a region called Moab. Moab sits on the east of the Dead Sea. So whether they traveled north or south, we don't know. But they go to this land of Moab. And you'll notice in the map here, Moab, this region, isn't occupied by a tribe. Okay, so this is what's technically like a foreign land that they move into. This is not a, it's actually hostile to the Israelites. And so they move into a land that's foreign to them. It's not part of any tribe that they're a part of. And so they move to Moab. Then the dad dies. So we're just told right out of the gate that the dad dies. And Naomi and her two sons remain, and they live in Moab now, and the two sons remain. And then we're told that the two sons marry Moabite women, okay? Moabite women. So these are non-Israelite people. So the two sons marry Moabite women. We're told the names are Orpah and Ruth, the Ruth of the story that we're reading, right? So they marry these two sons. Then the story tells us that they remain in this land for 10 years. So for 10 years, Naomi, the two sons, and their wives are hanging out, living, building a life together. And then the tragedy of the sick and wasting away takes place. The two sons die. The two sons die, leaving behind Naomi, Orpah, and Ruth. Now for a second, consider that type of devastation. Naomi is trying to survive. They move to a land, a foreign land that they're not familiar with, trying to just survive, to eat. Then your husband dies. And you're like, okay, we got to figure that out. And they begin to find some semblance of like moving forward and finding peace, and then your two sons die. I cannot imagine the amount of grief that Naomi must have gone through. The only comparison I can even empathize with was a few years ago when my brother died. And I remember coming home after the funeral, and it was a Monday, and I tried to go back to work the Monday after the funeral. I tried to go back to work, and I remember sitting at my computer in my home office, and I was trying to do a formula on a spreadsheet, and my brain was foggy. Like, I think I just sat there for probably 20 minutes, just blank stare into like nothing. And eventually I just had to like, I can't do this. And I got up from my desk and I went and I sat on our back porch and I just stared off the entire day. That lasted for like a week, where my brain was so foggy and so just in sadness that I couldn't even function. And so as I put myself in Naomi's shoes, I wonder what kind of brokenheartedness she was experiencing. Which when you just sit for a moment in this information, it makes what Ruth does later on that we'll explore so much more profound because of the brokenness of Naomi. So the story goes on. Ruth decides to go home. Ruth hears that the famine is lifted, and so she's like, it's time for me just to go. Like, I can't do this. I can't imagine that conversation. This is too hard for me to be here. I just need to get out of here. And so she heads home, and she tells the two girls, Orpah and Ruth, you need to stay behind. You just stay here. Start a new life. Naomi had nothing to offer them. The only thing that Naomi had to offer was poverty. Poverty and no home. Because where Naomi was going, there was nothing to sustain her, nothing to take care of her. Had nothing to offer. And Naomi realizes this and says, you stay. And so the story goes that Orpah stays in Moab and Ruth stays with Naomi. Ruth stays with Naomi. Now, in this opening chapter, there is so much going on that we could explore. I'm going to offer two observations just quickly, and then we're going to land on a third this morning where we're going to explore a little deeper. So the first observation, and the reason why I do this is part of what I believe in, like, teaching and preaching. I do a little bit more teaching than preaching, but what I believe is that hopefully I'm modeling to you how to wrestle with the text. So when I make these observations, I'm just trying to model for you, like, when we come to the text, we should ask questions. We should read with curiosity. Instead of just moving right through the story, that we should slow down and ask deeper, more meaningful questions. So this is me trying to model to you, how do you do that? Well, when I read this story, one thing that pops out to me is that Ruth was a Moabite. And Moabites were enemies to Israel. Moabites were the enemies of Israel. There's a story in Judges about this Moabite king. Eglon is his name. He's a Moabite king, and he attacks Israel, and he's trying to conquer Israel. And God raises up a left-handed warrior named Ehud to assassinate him. And left-handers in the house, right? We are useful, all right? We are useful. Ehud comes in, bam, to Eglon and kills him. So we have these stories. The Moabites were not friends of Israel. And so the question I have when I read this is, what does this tell us about who we think our enemies are? If God can use our enemies to bring about his Messiah, what kind of God are we serving? And who do we actually think our enemies are? That challenges me. God says, I'll use anybody, even the people you think are your enemies. There's another observation we can make here. So Naomi, Ruth, and Orpah and the sons, they lived together for 10 years. 10 years. And when you get to the declaration of Ruth about staying with Naomi, she says, your God will be my God. I'm sticking with you. What was it about Naomi that was so attractive for Ruth to abandon her heritage, her gods, to follow Naomi? What was it about Naomi? What did Naomi do in those 10 years that was so attractive that Ruth was willing to abandon everything to be with her? And that makes me wonder about myself. Is my life modeling God in such a way that people would abandon what they think about God in order to follow the God that I love and serve? What about my character? What about my life and my modeling to other people that could be like a Naomi and Ruth situation? How is your life modeling God in such an attractive way that people are willing to abandon what they believe and go, I'm going to try this God? That convicts me. Those are just a couple observations, and we could keep going, y'all. But I do believe there's something we need to hear this morning. And it's about this declaration that Ruth makes to Naomi. And it's found in chapter 1, verse 15, and I want to read it for you. It says this, look, said Naomi, your sister-in-law is going back to her people and her gods. Go back with her. But Ruth replied, don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where will I go? And where will I go? Sorry, where you go, I will go. And where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people and your God will be my God. Where you die, I will die. And there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me. When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. This proclamation by Ruth is so meaningful, let alone the idea, the concept, where you go, I will go. I'm going to be with you. I'm not leaving your side. Should remind us, our like spidey, you know, senses should be tingling right now to go, wait a minute. Where else do I hear someone's going to be with us? And the proclamation to Joseph about the name of Jesus is going to be Emmanuel. And Emmanuel means what? God with us, the with us God. What Ruth is doing is proclaiming a characteristic of God to Naomi, where you go, I'll go, should remind us of the God who is with us. Where we go, he will go. But that's not it. In fact, how profound this statement is can actually trace back to a statement that's been said earlier by Naomi. In verse 9 of chapter 1, Naomi says, may the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband. You see, what Naomi's trying to do is to say, you have a future. Like, you, if you stay with me, your future's done. I have nothing to offer you. You should go get remarried. You should experience happiness. Your future is still bright. You should go. And that's a noble thing for Naomi to do, to release these girls into finding a future for themselves. But Ruth's faithfulness to Naomi trumped her desire for what her future could be. This is incredible, that Ruth's desire to be faithful to Naomi and where she's at actually trumped what any future hope that she could have in happiness. Ruth exemplifies what it means to be present with hurting and broken people. It reminds me of Psalm 34, verse 18. The Lord is close to the brokenhearted and saves those who are crushed in spirit. And one thing you'll notice about this story in Ruth after this proclamation, Ruth didn't fix Naomi. Ruth didn't rescue Naomi. Ruth didn't say to Naomi, hey, you should probably just get over this. Like, it's going to be okay. Let's move on. No, Ruth was simply present in the brokenness. I'm not going anywhere. I'm here. I'm now. I'm present. And this, I think, is something we need a lot of in our world today. People who can just be present. I'm here. I'm not trying to fix you. I'm not trying to give you the solution to all your problems. I'm just here. You're not alone. And the thing is, if we're to be people who are present in the moment for others, it will require first that we trust. And this is what we're talking about. Faith is trust. Trust in the now and trust in the future. Because if we're to be truly present, it requires us to take our eyes off of the unknown future and to be present now, which requires trust. Do I trust that God is at work? Do I trust that it's going to be okay? Am I able to be present because I'm not living in the fear of tomorrow, the anxiety of the tomorrow, the things that catch my eye to make me worry and fear and doubt? And this is profound for us as Christians, because Jesus himself said, do not worry, do not be anxious. Jesus asks of us to be fully present and to trust him with the future. And what we see modeled in Ruth is an ability to be present now despite any lack of hope in her future. There was no secret, like, I think Naomi's secretly rich, so if I stay here, it's going to work out. No, she didn't have any of that. She was able to be present because there was a trust in the faithfulness of the God that Naomi served. She was willing to give it all and to be present. This is so important for us. Why is it hard for us to be present? Why is it hard for us to be in the moment with people? Whether it's because of the devices we have in front of our faces, we're not present. Maybe it's because the work schedule, we're trying to make, you know, all the money and get all the success and all the career. And we say things like, well, it's for the future of my family, but we're not present now. We have no relationship now. And God says, do you trust me? Do you trust that I'm at work so that you can be present? Trust, having faith in God and trusting that God is in control of the future allows us to actually be present. How do I be present? Joe, I don't know how to do it. There's so much going on. There's so much stress. Work on your trust. Learn to hand things over to God and surrender to him. I'm reminded of a writing by C.S. Lewis. It's called The Screwtape Letters. Anybody read that writing? If you haven't, it is a profound writing between it's a bunch of letters that C.S. Lewis is writing in, like, in this kind of reality of these two demons that are writing notes to each other. It's what the writing's all about. It's an easy read. You should go read it. Powerful. But these two demons, you have a chief demon, his name is Screwtape, and his nephew, a lesser demon called Wormwood. And it's all about, this writing's all about how to get, Wormwood has a human that he's trying to lead away from God, and he's struggling to do it. And so the chief demon, Screwtape, has to help give him instructions on how to best lead this human astray and away from God, okay? So that's what this writing's about. And in it, at one point, Screwtape is instructing Wormwood on the value of distracting the human away from the present. Why it's important to not let a human be present. And I want to read to you an excerpt from it. And it looks long. It's not that long. But I want you to listen. We'll have it up on the screen, how this goes. I think it's profound for our conversation. So this is what C.S. Lewis writes between this exchange of these two demons. So Screwtape is saying this. Our business is to get them away from the eternal and from the present. With this in view, we sometimes tempt a human, say a widow or a scholar, to live in the past. But this is of limited value, for they have some real knowledge of the past, and it has a determinate nature and, to that extent, resembles eternity. It is far better to make them live in the future. Biological necessity makes all their passions point in that direction already, so that thought about the future inflames hope and fear. Also, it is unknown to them, so that in making them think about it, we make them think of unrealities. In a word, the future is, of all things, the things least like eternity. It is the most completely temporal part of time, for the past is frozen and no longer flows, and the present is all lit up with eternal rays. Hence, nearly all vices are rooted in the future. Gratitude looks to the past, love to the present. Fear and greed, lust and ambition look ahead. He goes on to say, we want a whole race perpetually in pursuit of the rainbow's end, never honest nor kind nor happy now, but always using as mere fuel wherewithin to heap the altar of the future every real gift which is offered them in the present. What an interesting perspective on how the enemy gets our eyes off of what God's doing in the here and the now. And I love how C.S. Lewis writes these words. The present is the point at which time touches eternity. The present is the point at which time touches eternity. This is what we're invited into as followers of Jesus, to be present now, because God is at work. God is at work through you. And guess what? God is at work through the details of your life. The things that you think are monotonous and aren't meaningful, God is at work. Ruth's ability to trust God with her future so that she could be present now paved the way for the Messiah to come into the world. God is at work. God is at work through you. And God is at work in the details of your life. Do you trust that? Do you trust your present situation? The things that you're going through, they matter. They matter because God's at work. So as we wrap up this morning and we conclude here, I warned you about this. The same take home as the past 3 weeks, because I think this actually matters. Live in the reality to believe that God is at work everywhere all the time, and that God is looking to use you in that work, and that the little details of your life actually matter to God. And if we believe that this morning, then what I want you to wrestle with is this take home. And the take home's been the same thing for the past few weeks. But I believe that if we as the people of God live in the reality of this prayer, it will change the world. It will change people's lives. It will advance God's kingdom. And the prayers are this: God, give me eyes to see what you're up to. Help me to see, God, what's going on. And as God reveals to you what he's up to, it will present itself as an opportunity. As you see something, God, what are you up to? And you see someone brokenhearted and hurting, that becomes an opportunity for you. And so then the next question, next prayer is, God, give me the courage to step into that. Because the truth is, sometimes we just lack courage. We talk ourselves out of it. We begin to doubt. We say, I don't know if I can do that. I don't know if I should do that. God, give me courage that if this is the right time, I'll step into that reality. This is what I want you to wrestle with. And as we prepare for communion this morning, I want you to take a minute and begin to pray this prayer. Practice praying this prayer. And as you pray, God, help me to see what you're up to. Maybe even during this time of communion, as we reflect on what's been said, something will come to your mind, an opportunity where you know you need to make a phone call this week. Maybe right after the service. Maybe you need to drive over somewhere, meet up with somebody. There's an opportunity that God is inviting you into. Will you have the courage to step into it? As our ushers are making their way forward, there we go. Coming. They've got some communion. If you didn't grab communion on your way in, just lift your hand and our wonderful ushers will make sure that you got some communion. We're just going to take a few minutes and reflect on what God's saying to us here this morning. Let's do that now.